Baroque violinist Rachel Podger is celebrating her 50th birthday by recording the Four Seasons by Vivaldi for the very first time. It's all coming up this episode of New Classical Tracks. From American Public Media, I'm Julie Albacher. Enjoy. So, Rachel, you grew up in a very musical family where making music in a relaxed environment was just very natural for you and your family. Could you recreate that setting for us, please?
Yeah, well, I guess it was a very natural thing because both my parents are very musical. They're not professionals as such. My father's actually a priest, and my mother also studied theology. But my father was a choral scholar, first as a boy at King's College in Cambridge, and then later on as a student when he was studying theology in Cambridge. And so he was then a tenor. And so he experienced day in, day out, music making at a very, very high level. And he also plays various instruments, flute, piano. And my mother plays cello and guitar and recorder and just kind of lots of different things, and also tried a hand at violin actually when we started. So my brother and I, when we started to learn the violin, she learned it too, kind of with us. So there was always a kind of sense of doing it together. So it wasn't like, oh, okay, you need to go to your room now and practice. It didn't feel like a chore. So we always played tunes together when we started out, and we would play canons, kind of rounds, you know, that we knew because we sang them, and then we just play them on the instrument. So it seemed a very kind of natural way of learning music. And so that was kind of when we were really little, kind of from the age of five onwards. And then we joined, of course, you know, the local choir, school choir. This was still in England. And then we moved to Germany. And actually, still in England, we were learning the Suzuki method. And you do a lot of playing from memory, so by ear. So you actually learn the tune first, and then you translate what you know onto your instrument. And so it's very free, actually, the way of learning. So you're not kind of bound to kind of this weird code that you see in front of you, you know, the dots and the music, that for a child can seem like a weird thing to have to do. And so, again, it just felt then very natural to learn the notes, because you knew the tune already, and then you'd see the notes, you think, oh, okay, so I'm going up, so that goes up. And so that was a great way for me. It worked really well learning that way. And also the repertoire that you learn, you kind of work through four books, and you're often playing in a group of people, and everyone's kind of playing the same pieces. And so, yeah, and then we moved to Germany as a family. I was very musically active. As a family, we did lots of family concerts, partly to play in services for my father, because he was a parish priest there in Germany. And so we'd always play for festive times, you know, Easter, Christmas, even smaller festivities. And then it kind of became really a vehicle, a bit of an excuse to try out the new piece that you were playing. You know, you just kind of say, oh, Dad, can I play that on Sunday? And just to see how it feels, you know. And so people would be quite used to my brother and I playing in the services, and then often together too. And we sang a lot together. It was a little bit like a fun trap kind of thing.
I know that there was a new recording of a Bach cantata that really changed your life when you were growing up. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Yes. So I remember vividly coming home from school and coming, just entering the house, and I heard this music, and I could tell it was Baroque music. I could tell it was Bach. I was a teenager, I guess. I must have been about 13, 14. But it sounded very different to my ear, because they weren't playing with vibrato, and the lines were very, very clear. And I thought, oh, what's this? This is just really different. And so I asked my mother, you know, what is this? And she said, oh, we've got the latest recording from John Elliott Gardner, which he was then. He wasn't a sir then yet. And he started using historical instruments in the 70s, around 73 or so. This recording came out sometime in the 80s. And so they were fully fledged, you know, they kind of, at that point, they knew what they were doing with the Baroque instruments. And well, there was a kind of school of playing already at that point. And I hadn't really encountered it quite so far, you know, so much. And so with this recording, that really opened up a completely new world to me. And what struck me so strongly was actually I just loved the sound. I loved the direct gut string sound, and also the fact that I could hear all the lines because there was no vibrato being played. And I also loved the articulation, and somehow the music just spoke to me in a really, really different way. So from then on, I was hooked.
So is that also about the time that you started to become sort of inquisitive as a violin student, to the point where your teacher sent a note home telling your parents he couldn't teach you anymore?
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, you know my story well. That was actually, it felt, it's kind of funny now, but I was really upset at the time because I felt it was my fault, that the way you do when you're young. I just thought, oh no, what have I done? I've upset my teacher and now, you know, what am I meant to do next? He just didn't like the fact that I guess I was just doing my own individual thing, because I brought some Bach to him, some solo Bach. And I'd questioned certain things because he asked me to start a movement that to me seemed like it had a strong downbeat. It was a dance on an up bow. And I remember asking him, but isn't that strong? And wouldn't that be, you know, more idiomatic to do that on a down bow? I was just questioning that. And he then, I could see his face kind of turned. And he said to me, oh, gosh, oh, you're into that. And you've been bitten by that kind of bug. And it's, you know, be careful. It's only a fashion and it'll wane. And you need to stick to the mainstream and do the right thing. And I was really confused because to me it didn't seem like that. It just seemed like an interesting, intelligent way of looking at the music. That's how it seemed to me. And so, yeah, so I guess he just didn't like that very much. And I learned a lot from him. I mean, I learned masses of technique from him. And we did a lot of, he was from the kind of Russian school of playing. And so we did a lot of Binyavsky and Tchaikovsky and stuff like that, and lots of studies. And so that really set me up technically. So I was very, very appreciative of what he taught me. But yes, he wasn't inclined towards the historical performance.
Well, it's interesting because then eventually you went off to study violin at the Guildhall School of Music, and you actually hid your Baroque violin from your teachers and the other students. Tell me why you did that.
Well, at that time, this is late 80s, early 90s, so, I mean, if you compare it to now, you know, now you can study a Baroque instrument as an undergraduate study, and it's pretty mainstream, and there are regular auditions for different Baroque orchestras. There's a lot of work around. It's a choice that you can make when you're an instrumentalist. At that point, I wasn't that aware of it being a kind of, you know, something that you would regularly undertake. So I was, of course, really feverish about it. I really wanted to learn as much as I could. And there was actually a teacher at the Guildhall School of Music who called Michaela Comberti. But she only taught a second study, you know, so not your main instrument. And so I went to her and I asked her, you know, I really would like to do this. I don't actually have an instrument. And how do I do this? And she said, well, you're in your first year and you're actually not really meant to do this in your first year. You're meant to do it in your second year. First of all, I went to the director of music and asked him whether I could have my second study, not on the piano, which you were meant to do in the first year, but whether I could have either additional lessons or split the amount of lessons so I could have some on Baroque violin. And he said, well, you're meant to really, you know, consolidate your technique on your main instrument in your first year. And I didn't say anything, but I really, in my mind, I was thinking, well, actually, I think, you know, my technique's kind of okay, isn't it? I remember thinking that, which was really presumptuous, because we can always learn more, can't we? We can always learn more. I was just so keen to get started with the repertoire, because I knew there was masses of stuff out there and unknown things and 17th century music and hidden away in libraries. And so I did then take some lessons with this teacher, but it was kind of behind the back of everyone, really. So I wasn't really meant to, and that's why I hid the instrument. So if I walked into the college with my normal modern violin case, I then had another case. And if people then asked me, I just wasn't really sure what to say. So I used to hide it behind my back, yeah.
You have been involved with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, the English Concert, the Palladian Ensemble, just to name a few. You're involved as a teacher, a professor of Baroque violin at both the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and the Royal Wales College of Music and Drama. And you come to Juilliard and you teach three times a year, not to mention the fact that you have formed another ensemble, which is featured on your new recording, the Brecon Baroque. Let's talk a little bit about that ensemble and how they came to be.
Yes, I'm very excited and very proud of that group. It basically happened because, just a little backstory. So I just started a family with my hubby, and we wanted to move out of London. He's also a musician from Wales originally. So he said, let's move to Wales. So for me, it seemed very much out of the way, and because I didn't know it so well. And okay, it's like three and a half hours or four hours in the car, which of course in American terms is absolutely nothing, but in European terms is a really long way. So we settled down in this place called Brecon, and there was a music festival there which concentrated on Baroque music, and I was approached by the director then to get involved, and so I did, and Tim, my husband as well, and they were very keen to get youth together to do some things, and so we did that, and we set up an orchestra, and then we also wanted to do a concert with a chamber group, and so I thought, gosh, this is a great opportunity. I'm just going to ask all my favourite people. So I asked various colleagues who I studied with at the same time, and then also some ex-students of mine who were really, really wonderful. And so this group kind of came together, and that was really the birth of the group. So that kind of happened around 2007 to 2006, 2007 or so, and has grown since then. And it was also, I guess, always a kind of ideal of mine to direct a group. So not to have a conductor, but to actually be directing from the violin. And that's what happens in that group. Having said that, everyone is very much a player in their own right and very individually brilliant. And so it's really like just a group of, well, I guess, soloists who then play really, really well together. So it's not like I'm, you know, there at the front calling the shots and telling them what to do. It's kind of doesn't really work like that. It's more of a kind of chamber group feel in terms of rehearsals and how decisions are made. And often, you know, we'll play through a piece and there'll be loads and loads of things that I hadn't thought of that people are just doing, and I'm thinking, oh, actually, that's brilliant. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, go you. It goes hand in hand with the repertoire, you know, especially if you're a continuo player, so whether you're playing the harpsichord or the organ or the lute. Yeah, so you're playing the bass line, but you're playing of course the harmonies as well, but you're improvising as you go with your right hand or your melody, a counterpoint, stuff that's not written down. And that, I think, that's just really liberating for those players. There's actually one bit in the concerto, the Il Grosso Mogul, which is the last piece on the disc, which is a fantastically wild piece. It really is fantastic. There's one bit which I had envisaged as quite light in the accompaniment. So I'm playing a lot of notes, rapid figuration in my line. And the continuo just has a kind of quaver, so eighth note accompanying line. And I expected that to be quite light. Anyway, they started doing all sorts of kind of rock and roll stuff, you know, strumming away and adding a few rhythms. And at first I thought, okay, all right. And we kept that in the end. I think it works really well.
You mentioned some of the instrumentation, which actually may be new to some ears who are familiar with The Four Seasons, for example, with a more modern ensemble. Let's talk a little bit about some of the textures that are added from instruments like the theorbo and the harpsichord and the chamber organ, and where we hear that in those concertos.
It adds a lot of variety and a lot of richness, and you can do anything with it, really. You can get some kind of dry sounds. You can get some wonderfully luxuriant kind of strummy sounds as well. Let's think about a particular movement. So if we're thinking about the middle movement of Winter, that one. And so you've got the rain in the violins. So they're doing pizzicato, and it's marked forte, so it's kind of quite strong rain. And they're playing a kind of regular rhythm. I obviously have the tune, and then in the bass, you've just got these eighth notes with the harmonies, of course. And so that's all that's given. So what do you do with that? So we tried all sorts of things. So we had the organ playing sustained. Then we had the lute kind of doing some movement, kind of plucking. And then we tried different things. We tried kind of more of a middle register in terms of where the notes lie. So not so much soprano, but more kind of alto towards tenor. And we tried that to see how that would sound. And then we also tried it with harpsichord too. and we even tried, I think, one hand on the harpsichord, one hand on the organ, which was hilarious. And I remember we actually had to stop the tape because we were all just grinning and just laughing too much. So just because it sounded so intriguing and so different and very exciting. So in the end, when we put the takes, you know, when we had to decide which take, it was actually quite tricky to choose which one.
Oh my gosh, I'm thinking back to when you were a little kid growing up and you all were making music and just having fun with it.
Yeah, it's a bit like that.
Yeah, that joy that you've had from the very beginning continues, and like going to music school and everything thing didn't suck that out of you. One of the things that I've noticed in listening to this recording is there are times when this little orchestra of eight people sounds so much fuller. I mean, I literally had to go and count them again, going, really, this is only eight people? And I'm thinking like maybe in the first and the third movement of Summer when it's very dramatic and so full.
Yes, I think that various people have been quite astonished how much volume we got. But that's the great thing about gut strings, is that you can, if you go into the string with a bow, which of course the gut string lets you do because it's porous, and there's a kind of give in the string, which is very different from a wound string on modern instruments. And so if you do that, if you let your bow go right in there, you get the most amazing volume and a very kind of gutsy sound. What I mean by that is there's a kind of natural articulation that happens because just the nature of the friction between this very differently shaped baroque bow and this gut string, especially the thicker gut strings, the lower you go. So on a violone, for instance, you know, which is the bass instrument that we use, the 16-foot, it sounds incredible. It's really powerful when you do some what I call scrubbing, you know, kind of fast notes on the bottom strings, and you can see the string going bananas. Thank you.
So why was now the right time to record The Four Seasons by Vivaldi?
Well, partly because I had I have a significant birthday coming up, and I kind of thought, I want to do something that kind of, honors that in a way. And that wasn't really the main reason. The main reason was it felt like the right time because I felt I'd explored lots of other of the concertos. So I started out with some of the more unknown ones. He wrote a lot of concertos, as we know, about 230-something for violin alone. So I just wanted to take time to get to know as many concertos, as much music by him as possible, to understand the man, to understand where he directs his thoughts and where they all come from. And it's just so interesting to get under the skin of the music and to try and understand the composer as much as possible. And at first I was thinking of recording the whole of the Opus 8 concertos, but because of the nature of the Four Seasons, even though they're just the first four concertos of the Opus 8, so there are eight more concertos in that opus, it kind of felt right for that to just be a complete piece by itself, because they are the Four Seasons, and then to add some other concertos into that also had particular names. Il Grosso Mogul was always a very strong candidate to go on that disc, because it's so very different and fiery and has these crazy cadenzas that were written by Vivaldi that go on forever. And are very virtuosic and tricky. You kind of think, what's going to happen next? The two other concertos that we chose are more kind of sorbets in between. There's the beautiful one, Il Riposo di Natale, which of course is Christmassy, and that seemed to follow really well after winter, and also harmonically harks back to spring because it's all in the same key as spring, because it's E major. And that's in itself a really pretty, very special piece. There's no harpsichord, and the texture is very high. Everyone plays rather high, and it's all muted, so it kind of feels like a little bit like when you've had the snow and you can't really hear the traffic, and it's all kind of muted and twinkly and a bit magical.
This week on New Classical Tracks, Vivaldi's Four Seasons on period instruments, and next time you'll have a chance to hear Vivaldi's Four Seasons recomposed. It's on a new recording featuring violinist Francisco Fujana. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julia Macher.